Who are you? What makes you you? No, really, does your job define you? Your genes, maybe your religious affiliation, or a personality type? An INFJ or an ESTJ? How would you find out who you really are and where that sense of self comes from? There are thousands of approaches, some scientific, like getting your brain scanned or your genome sequenced. There are others, not so much. Ever take one of those online personality quizzes? Which Star Trek character are you? In her new book, Me, Myself, and Why, science journalist Jennifer Ouellette asked that question about herself. And, of course, being a great science writer, she set out to find what science can tell us about who we are. Her search for science of self took her inside an MRI machine, into a lab filled with drunken fruit flies, try that at home, and even took her on an LSD trip, which I guess you could try at home. And she is here to talk about what she discovered. She's author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She's in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. How did you get started on this idea?
It's ironic. I normally write about physics.
Right.
My last book was about calculus. And while I was writing that book, I realized that this notion that I had of myself as being bad at calculus really was not based in reality. It had become an integral part of my identity. But when I went back and looked at my high school transcripts, I found that I was actually really good at math. I got A's in all my math classes. So where did this notion come from, and how did it become such a huge part of who I thought I was? And I'm also, the second prong is that I'm an adopted child. So the nature versus nurture debate is one that really hits home.
Right.
Because you're always wondering how much of who I am is from my biological parents and how much is from my upbringing and my adoptive parents.
All right. Now, being a science writer and someone who deals with science a lot, don't you have to define terms first?
Yes.
Right?
And this was hard.
What is self? How do you define self?
Honestly, that was the hardest part. It was the first thing I did, and it took me several months of talking to people, because how you define self really depends on what kind of scientist you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a neuroscientist is really going to focus on the neurons. A biologist is really going to focus on your genome, or as we learned in a couple segments ago, proteomics. All of these things do contribute, but the self is kind of all of those. It's all of those things put together and integrated into this whole, where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So I actually ended up going back to William James, because he said the self is everything that a person is: his bank account, his family, his person, his physical self, his social relationships. All of those things come together and influence who we are.
Mm-hmm. You think he was onto something there?
I think he was. You know, he was a very smart man. It was the turn of the century, right? But he was onto something.
Could you find whether nature is better than over nurture, or it's all part of
Of the same thing? I mean, apparently it's the wrong question to ask, which was an important thing for me to learn right there. You know, so there is definitely a genetic component to so much of who we are, and genes are incredibly powerful. They definitely lay down a scaffolding of sorts, and we lay all kinds of layers on top of that to become who we are.
So you started out on this trek of all kinds of testing.
Yes,
right?
I did.
What did you do first?
Well, the first was the obvious one. I got my genotype done through 23andMe, where you spit in a tube and then they sequence certain markers. It's not a full genome. It's something called SNPs, where they're kind of known segments, and they test for certain traits.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I had my brain scanned. And then I took personality tests, and I figured those were the three most common things that we think about when we think about self.
Mm-hmm. And did you learn enough? Were you a little scared about getting the 23andMe test done, what you might turn up that you didn't know?
No, I don't think so. I've read things from other people who found long-lost relatives,
right.
And, you know, maybe that would have been a little awkward, but you don't have to meet them. I guess I'm one of those people that prefers to know, and I think it depends on your temperament. I mean, there are some people, I think, who prefer not to know about their risk for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. You know, even though these things are preliminary and the studies aren't final and we don't really know everything that goes into why people come down with these diseases, I want to know if there's an increased risk. I just want to know.
Yeah. But the thing most people don't realize is they don't do your whole genome. Right?
No, they don't.
No, they do what? They do certain parts.
They're called SNPs. They're certain markers on certain parts of the genome that they know are associated with specific traits. But it's a very limited analysis, because obviously there can be 50 or 60 genes that contribute to, say, your risk of alcoholism, and they only test for three or four. So this is a small part of your genetic risk profile, not the whole thing. And I think the worry, mm-hmm. possibly a valid one, is that people could overinterpret their results.
And how did you interpret your results? What did that test tell you?
Well, it taught me how complicated genes were. For me, it was a perfect laboratory for really learning about how genetics works, because I think that I'd had a very naive, simplistic, almost Mendelian thought process about how it worked. And it's so much more complicated, because as we learned in your couple of segments ago, genes code for proteins, and proteins come in many different varieties, and they're involved in many different traits, and they all interact together. So even eye color or height has several genes.
Right. Talking with Jennifer Ouellette, author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. There's sort of a little colorblind test. Is that a real test?
It is not a real test. We tested it on colorblind people to make sure they could still see it.
I was trying to wonder whether I'm not colorblind. I could see a little question mark in there. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, if you'd like to talk with Jennifer Ouellette, author of Me, Myself, and Why. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. We'll take a little break and come back right after this. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Talking with an author, Jennifer Ouellette, author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for Science of Self on Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You are so prolific on Facebook at finding at finding stuff. I don't know how you have time to write a book. You're doing so many of these things. How can back to the early days, you talk about this in the book. In the early days of brain research, we're always trying to find a part of the brain where something is located.
Right.
Right. Did they try to find the part of the brain where the self is located in all that research?
Absolutely they have. And what they've found is it depends, again, on what you're looking for. I mean, there's different parts of the brain associated with the body map, for instance, or how we determine self versus other, where we end and something else begins. Facial recognition, there's a whole different part of the brain for that. There's the default network, which is associated with basic wakefulness or consciousness. But there's no single place where the self resides. And the brain itself, our notion of it, and I say our scientific notion of it, has moved away from this sort of, lots of little different regions to a vast network of networks, a sort of great interconnected complex network of networks, where all of the brain is involved in everything. It's just that certain types of processing are more concentrated in different areas. Mm-hmm. But nothing is really experienced fully, consciously, unless that information is integrated across the entire brain. And that, to me, was fascinating, because I really did think that there was like a God spot gay spot or whatever.
As someone who does a lot of physics writing, you're a reductionist, right?
Exactly. I want things to be simple. This was a very frustrating book to write from that respect.
I would imagine that would be true, right?
Right.
You want to have cause and effect. You want to see how the things are made, and you can't do that.
There are way too many variables.
Yeah. That's frustrating. That's why you took acid. Tell us about that episode. Are you scary? Talking to it? Or? Done it before?
I had never done it. I mean, the irony, of course, is that I don't do drugs at all, which is kind of pathetic of me. I don't respond well to them. And in fact, even acid made me a little nauseous. But
what was it like?
It was really cool, actually. It did not upset me at all. I'd had a lot of good advice. You have to control your environment. These psychedelics are very unpredictable. Mm-hmm. So staging is very important. I think it would have been upsetting to me to do it at a loud, raucous party. Among other things, your self-other boundary, where you end and the world begins, gets really blurred. Like, my hand kept melting into the table, and I couldn't take notes.
You tried to take notes during your trip?
Yes. I have a picture of my scrawled, incoherence. And it was little things like, molecules, man. You got to go down to the molecules. Everything gets quantized.
Wow. If the physics part of you is coming out.
The physics part came out, yes.
Yeah. And so what happened? Did you have a good trip?
It was very good trip, actually. And I actually kind of liked that disembodied feeling, of feeling like kind of, your molecules get dispersed. But what was interesting to me was there was still an I. It's not like the I ceased to exist. And that was what I was looking for, because it was described to me as acid dissolves the ego. And I wanted to experience that. And I think it depends, again, how you define ego. But if there's an I there, that basic I, then yourself is still intact. So that's not what acid does. It messes with your self-other boundary, your body maps a little bit. But there's still an I there. And so to me, that's very interesting.
And you came away with understanding what at this? Because you're looking to find all these, putting the pieces together.
Right. The acid chapter was designed to help me start to explore a much more meta area of consciousness and where this basic fundamental I comes from. Because if you think about the self, there's many layers, right? But ultimately, you peel back the layers and you get back to that fundamental I. When we're born, from the moment we're born, we experience the world from our singular perspective, and that becomes the I, and it's the single most important thing, the aspect of the self. Mm. So to me, I wanted to have an experience that kind of focused on that.
Yeah, Steve Jobs, famously dropped acid a lot.
Yes.
Look what he did. You know?
Well, my husband is a physicist, and he dropped acid with me, and he wanted to see if he had any big breakthroughs into, like, a theory of everything, and he basically said, you can't do any real physics on that, because it's hard enough just to make a bagel.
How long does it last?
It lasted 6 to 8 hours, I think. Yeah. We ended up taking it in the morning, and then we couldn't sleep, so we ended up mainlining Game of Thrones Season 1.
Wow, no munchies.
Yeah.
You also took two personality tests, the Myers-Briggs and the Big Five.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, the Myers-Briggs is the most common one. It came out of Jungian psychology, but I'm not sure Jung would be a huge fan, but it's the one everybody takes, where it tells you whether you're an INFJ or whatever, and it measures these four parameters that are supposed to be fundamental to personality, and it gives you a category. And the problem with that is that personality is more of a continuum. And this is very obvious when I've taken the test more than once.
Right.
When I was younger, I was in a slightly different category, and yet your personality is supposed to be, your basic temperament is supposed to be basically set. So what accounts for that? And we evolve. We move along a continuum. Our basic temperament might not change, but I've definitely become more extroverted, less anxious, all of these things, more thinking rather than feeling over the years.
Right.
And that has influenced my personality, but probably I haven't changed much with respect to the rest of the population.
How close were these to IQ tests, like we used to think?
I don't think so. They're not much close to IQ tests at all. They're self-reported. They're a lot like elaborate, you know, BuzzFeed quizzes to a certain extent. They're forced choice. They give you two options. Here's a situation. You do what? And pick, you know, two to four options of those. Which one are you most likely to do? And the problem is it's self-reported and it's forced choice. And some of those they're situation dependent. I might behave one way in one situation, in one context, in another way, in a different one. So they can be inaccurate.
So they're not IQ tests. Did you think about taking some IQ tests?
I did not. I decided not to cover IQ. I had to limit things somehow, and I think IQ is, I think it's kind of a non-issue. I mean, you can have a high IQ, but what are you doing with that IQ? And I think sometimes we overemphasize that.
Do you think that any of these personality tests can predict your behavior or how you would behave in it?
That, I think, is extremely difficult. What I think the best way to think of it is it can make a statistical prediction of how you are likely to behave. Not in any one given situation, because as I said, it varies. But over time, if it can look at the decisions you made, you know, over time in lots of different related ways and kind of make, okay, she tends to do this in such situations. Mm. That's about as close as you can get.
Talking with Jennifer Ouellette, author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. If you have a question, maybe you've searched and you're still looking, our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. I've mentioned the drunk fruit flies.
Oh, God, yes.
Well, can you learn anything? Tell us, what do you learn? Why are scientists getting fruit flies drunk?
This is a scientist at University of California, San Francisco, Ricky Huberlin. I had met her a few years ago, and she had told me her stories of drunken fruit flies, so I wanted to visit her lab. She essentially is trying to find the various genes that influence alcohol tolerance, because that's one of the primary factors that influences your risk for alcoholism. And what she does is she knocks out one particular kind of gene. She breeds batches of fruit flies, and she'll knock out or activate one particular kind of gene and then see how they respond. And there's a particular gene that she just called cheap date. And apparently I am cheap date. I'm the ultimate anti-alcoholic lightweight.
Right.
But those are the ones that just never develop any kind of tolerance. I am a two-drink girl, and I've been a two-drink girl all my life, and I can never drink more than two drinks. Mm-hmm. I just don't build up. Mm-hmm. So I can never drink enough, really, to become an active alcoholic.
Right. That's a good thing, I guess. So, being cheap dating.
There are, of course, other factors that go into that. But the fruit flies are fun because they really do act like us. When you watch them in the lab, she puts them in a vaporizer that's got, like, ethanol vapor. And they get really happy and buzzed, like everybody's suddenly the life of the party. And then they start to lose motor control. Then they start hitting on flies of the wrong gender. And finally, they kind of tumble down and decide that the pavement is really, really comfortable, and they're just going to go to sleep right there. And you can definitely see a human parallel, even though it's dangerous to do that.
Maybe that's where the word buzzed came from. You know, somebody did it with some insects before. These days, the self is online, too.
Yes.
There's Jean-Luc Picon.
Yes.
Instead of Jean-Luc.
My avatar alter ego. She's also my Twitter handle. You mentioned my Facebook page. I mean, she's the one who tweets all those interesting links while I'm writing books.
Yeah. Do you think that social media has changed ourselves in a fundamental way? In other words, now that we have the avatar, our Facebook self, our Twitter self, mm-hmm. have we given away part of ourself? It's a two-part question by doing this. Do we need that now because everybody else does it to be a fully whole self?
I don't really see it as something new or dangerous. Yeah. Believe it or not, I think that what we're doing is pretty much the same thing we've always done when it comes to how we manage our public self. It's just that there's now a new realm into which we've extended it. One of the most amazing things about the self and how the brain processes and constructs a self is that it's so flexible. It can expand and contract and adapt. And that public face, your avatar or your Twitter handle or that thing that goes out in public to represent you, is an extension of you. And we've always done that, whether it's through magazines or books or cameras, taking photographs. And I think it's always natural to assume every time there's a new technology that something's being lost. But I can see that it's just a different realm. And the brain is doing what it's always done.
Mm-hmm. Now, as an avatar, Jean-Luc Picon, do you think that's allowed you to do things you wouldn't do in normal life?
She's a fun thing because she sometimes is my mouthpiece. If there's something kind of snarky that I don't really want to say, I can put it in her mouth. And she can say it, and it gives me a little bit of distance. But only a little, because more and more it's starting to become more of an extension of me.
Well, I was going to say, what do you think the avatar of the future is going to be like?
It's interesting. I've been hanging out in Second Life. I did so for the book, and I have a whole version, a full-body version of Jean-Luc Picon in Second Life. And I think that, you know, Second Life people get mad at me for saying this, but it really is, you know, a crude, basic, not user-friendly interface the way it currently exists.
Yeah, we used to be on Second Life.
Yes, but I do think something like that is coming. But we need to have something more like Wii, where you can have a gestural thing where your avatar, when you move your hands, your avatar will move a certain way. Because right now, Second Life is kind of static. But it is fascinating in terms of identity. I interview a lot of scientists in Second Life, and I always look forward to seeing what they choose. Like Jan 11, the astrophysicist chose to be a unicorn with bunny ears and a little punk dress. And Simon DeDeo, who's a complexity scientist, was a swarm of butterflies. So it really says something about who they see themselves as, what they choose as their avatar.
Now you're projecting, right?
I got a little.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Jennifer Willett, author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. Did you find enough to be satisfied in your search about yourself?
You know, I don't think I found an answer. And, you know, that's a null result in some respects, which is kind of disappointing. I think that, you know, if my goal had been to come up with this elaborate ultimate theory of the self, I would have been crushingly disappointed. But it was such a fun ride. And I learned so much about who I am and how flexible my sense of self is. You know, what I can change, mm-hmm. what I can't change, what's deterministic and what's something that I have some influence and control over, finding that happy medium. And it made me think a little more deeply about physicality and, you know, what's real and what isn't. And mm-hmm. you
was, know, Descartes, what, was Descartes right?
Descartes was wrong, in my opinion.
Tell us what he said.
Descartes, it's called the mind-body problem. Descartes was of the impression that there is the physical self and then there is a intangible soul sort of thing. And of course, the problem there is how do those things interact if they're separate? Mm-hmm. And every neuroscientist that I interviewed for the book said the same thing. Mind is matter. They're the same thing. I think Steven Pinker said it last night at a World Science Festival panel, mm-hmm. it's neurons all the way down. It's the activity of those neurons that give rise to a sense of self. And you cannot have one without the other.
You describe yourself as an emergent phenomenon. Is
yes.
that like a butterfly emergent? Or
no,
what
emergence
kind of?
in the sense of a complexity. If you think about a traffic jam, you know, traffic is moving along. Where does a traffic jam come from? What happens? The cars get dense enough mm-hmm. that suddenly this new phenomenon emerges out of the interactions and activity of all those cars, and you get a traffic jam. The same thing happens with a lump of gold. It's made out of billions of atoms, correct? And it has certain properties of temperature and color and hardness. And those properties are not intrinsic to the atoms. There's something that bigger than the parts of the whole, something that emerges out of that. So it's a higher level property, but it's real. And to my mind, basic consciousness is like that. The self is like that.
Mm. Do you think robots are going to be able to do that?
We were just having that discussion over dinner last night, and everybody really kind of split down the middle. It would be very difficult, I think. If you could have a robot with certain analogs of physical inputs, I think that would be very interesting, because I think we don't fully appreciate how important our physical body is to our sense of self.
Because you read about, science fiction now is full, I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
It's full of post-apocalyptic robotic stuff.
Right.
In which robots take over the world, or we take them over, but them getting enough sense of themselves and intelligence that
right.
they don't need us anymore.
Right. And I think, I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying that it's going to be extremely difficult, and you've got to find ways to simulate all the different physical mm-hmm. aspects that make us who mm-hmm. we are. And we're not even sure how it works with us,
yeah.
never mind how to simulate it.
Now, if someone reads your book and wants to take the same journey as you did, would you recommend they do that?
I absolutely would. I mean, it depends on the personality. Bear in mind that if you take the a genotyping test, you might find out some things, so be prepared. But the surprises are part of the journey, negative or positive.
Mm-hmm. Anything you would do differently? Any test that you left out? Any test you didn't need after you?
I think I didn't need the brain scan, to be honest. The fMRI, the whole chapter is basically about how the fMRI didn't tell me anything about me as a person. And that was not David Eagleman's fault.
Yeah.
I was part of a group study. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist in Texas who did my brain scan for me. But I would have had to take an individual scan, be part of an individual scan rather than a group one, because that's something in aggregate, not something about me personally. And that's much, much harder to do. So I would skip the brain scan, I think.
Add anything else?
No, I think I hit all the good stuff.
Well, it is good stuff. It's a great read. It's Jennifer Ouellette's book, Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. I guess you've solved the problems of life. You don't have to write anymore, right?
I've at least defined the questions.
He's defined the questions. And we'll look forward to more of your Facebook pages.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And is there another book in the works here?
I have a fledgling idea. I'm going back to physics for the next one.
Physics.
So,
good. You're a great physics writer. Thank you, Jennifer. Jennifer Ouellette, author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. It's out now. Oh, you can read an excerpt from her book on our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/me, myself, and why.